You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Martha McPhee's latest novel, Dear Money, a critically acclaimed but financially struggling novelist gives up the writing life to become a bond trader at the height of the mortgage-backed securities boom. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Martha McPhee to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The heroine of your book, India Palmer, sounds a lot like you. She's had four novels published, all to good reviews. She teaches writing, lives in New York, has a husband who's also in the arts. So is this a road not taken story?
In some ways, but she's not me. She's tall and beautiful, and she has...
Don't put yourself down.
She has...
this is radio. You're perfect.
She has a lot of... she's game. She has a lot of ambition, and I have ambition, but I don't think I would end up on Wall Street and be able to do a lot of the things they do down there.
Well, she meets a very successful bond trader named Wyn Johns at the summer home of some friends, and he tells her he can turn her into a bond trader in 18 months. Were you propositioned in the same way? And I use that word because that's the word that India uses, proposition.
Yes, and I used it too in an article I wrote for Business Week. I was at a garden party in New Jersey, and this man arrived who was apparently, I could tell he oozed a lot of wealth. And I wanted to get to the bottom of I knew he was a banker. What do they do? For me, they all did one thing. They just made a lot of money. And so I started chatting him up, and we talked for quite a while. And he told me he was a mortgage-backed securities trader. A what? This was 2004. I had really no idea what that was. And he explained, and I was fascinated as he explained. And he also said, there's nothing to it. Anybody can do it. We're just used car salesmen. We're just selling mortgages, people's puny debts, instead of pooled together into these massive bonds. But anybody can do it. And
did he tell you he was selling Pintos instead of good cars?
He did get into some types of cars, but I can't really remember what they were. But at the end of the conversation, he said, if you give me 18 months, I'll turn you into a trader.
He really said that.
He did say that.
And did you believe that could be true?
I was like, really? You know, a little kid sort of, my eyes popped open. But I was immediately fascinated with the idea of the Pygmalion story that was possible here.
But there's also a seduction aspect to this, although not a sexual one.
Yes.
Is this a world where money is more tempting than sex?
I don't know if I would make such a generalization, but I definitely am playing with that a bit in the novel. She ends up, in a sense, having a love affair with money, and I'm sort of teasing that out in the first half of the story. Is she going to have a literal affair, or is she really having this other kind of affair?
But in either case, it almost feels like a betrayal of her marriage.
Yes, and she feels exactly as good as if she were having an affair.
And I suspect you gave him the name Wyn because... he always seems to win.
Yeah, I guess. I met somebody at the same time named Wyn, and I thought, oh, well, that's just perfect.
India and her husband, Theodore, who's a goldsmith and sculptor, are fairly successful as artists, but their income pales in comparison to their friends who are investment bankers and the like. So they could live pretty well within their means, but not like millionaires?
Well, yes, but they're always kind of trying to figure out what the next trick is. And they live in a rent-stabilized apartment. The ceiling is falling in. It keeps the rent low. And she's sort of tired of all the tricks.
But I don't know. Have you spoken to other artists about this? I've always thought that the pleasures of doing something you love, making art, is rewarding in itself. And some people don't want that trade-off.
I think there are plenty of people that don't, and it's a very but I also think it's a sort of romantic idea to think of, you know, the cash-strapped artist getting by on the love of art. And, you know, if you look back to literature, I just read George Gissing's New Grub Street.
A great book.
It's a fantastic book. but I sort of wish I had read it while I was writing Dear Money. It would have given me a little more license, I think, because the world he describes is anything but romantic, but feels very real, very contemporary.
But his writer is a hack writer, and your writer is not a hack writer.
Well, one of his writers is a hack writer. Reardon is not. Jasper is.
You describe a facet of New York social life in which millionaires collect artists and artists collect millionaires. Is this something new to New York? Because it's opposite to what happens in Red, the play about Mark Rothko's decision to renege on a commission to make paintings for the Four Seasons restaurant.
I don't know if I can if I have an you know an, a complete or an answer for that that would you know I think it's more of a generalization. It's more of things that I was observing being a writer in New York City in the mid-2000s, where wealth really did take over everything.
Well, we do have artists like Jeff Koons, and we had just read in the Times the other day about a serious writer who's now writing a vampire novel.
Yes, so. I saw that. I did see that.
This is what happens to India. She insists on sending her daughters to the same expensive private school her friends send their kids to, buying clothes that she can't afford and so on. So is she, in essence, setting herself up for failure, or at least the necessity of finding a way to make more money?
I guess she's just tempted. I think, you know, a lot of people are tempted. I mean, how did we get into this housing crisis? I mean, there are many, many different reasons for why. But there's a lot of temptation out there. And I think that I was trying to look at that in a very honest way, especially in New York. You know, you walk down a street and the stores are perfumed and want to draw you in, and there is a beautiful dress in the window, and, you know, it's sort of partaking of the dessert tray. And I think there are quite a few people that would like to partake of that dessert tray.
My guest is Martha McPhee. Her latest novel is called Dear Money. And the concept that you're describing, keeping up with the Joneses, is a recurring theme in this book. Isn't that more of a suburban phenomenon, or is that something that we just didn't want to believe that was happening in the big city?
Of course it's happening. It happens everywhere, all across the world. You know, I was one of the things I was very interested in are, you know, who are the characters like Lily Bart, Scarlett O'Hara, even Undine Sprague, or Becky Sharp? Who would they be today if they found themselves, especially Lily Bart? I don't think she would have killed herself today. I think she would have come up with some way to get out of her predicament.
At first, India pretends, at least to her husband Theodore, that she's working as a trader so she can write about it. And then she realizes that she's doing it because she really wants to be a trader.
Well, I think she's actually lying to him in the beginning, and that's part of this betrayal. And when he, when she finally realizes she has to confess to him, he laughs. And he says, essentially, you know, I married an artist, you are an artist, and this is just a phase. This is just a Duchampian experiment. It's, you will continue to be a novelist.
Well, there is a big difference if you succeed or fail. A friend got into real estate because she was having a hard time struggling as an artist, and got in at the wrong time, and wound up just dropping out. She took all of the tests, you know, did everything she had to do to get a real estate license.
Oh, gosh.
And now she's back to trying to make it as an artist. But if you really succeed, that can be seductive in itself.
You mean if you really succeed
and start making a lot of money?
Yes, exactly. I think it can be. And she's succeeding at the height of the bubble. She's succeeding when everybody was succeeding. So I don't think it's a real success.
Ironically, India and Theodore's best friends, Emma and Will, go through a reverse process. Will gives up his successful career as an investment banker to become a novelist.
That's right. Yes, that's another trope I was playing with.
So is the grass always greener?
Well, I think a lot of people think that that's true. But then when you go down that road, you you either discover that it isn't, you usually do, I would think. But for him, he makes a very successful career as a writer, but he doesn't have the banker's income anymore.
There's a lot of professional jealousy among the writers in this book, the agents, the publishing houses, the award nominations, where and when the reviews come out, if they even get reviews. They're all ranked and carefully monitored. I'd like to think that there's an element of satire in that, but I suspect this is really the way it is.
I think there's an element of satire throughout the novel. It's, you know, sort of just looking at a silly time in our historic period.
One of India's friends from graduate school, Lily Starr, has spent 15 years writing her first novel, and when it's published, it wins all the awards and turns her into a literary star overnight. How often does that happen?
It happens. It happens. Certainly. I can't name anybody on the top of my head, but it happens.
And then we have real estate. When you were writing this book, were you writing it during the boom?
I actually started thinking about this in 2004 when I was propositioned, as I like to say. And it was, you know, sort of at the beginning of a lot of the bubbling. And I started reading a lot. And by 2007, I couldn't keep up with all the articles. And I was in the thick of the writing.
But in a way, it must have been a good time because so much was being written about all of this and the machinations of this field. Before then, you would have had to have gone to some bond trader's office.
Well, I did go to bond trader's offices. I did go to trading floors, and I did my research because I wanted the second half of this novel, which is shaped like an hourglass. The first half is the descent of the novelist, and the second half is the rise of the trader. So I did a lot of research. In 2004, 2005, 2006 even, there wasn't that much being written. There were some very key things, and I earnestly clipped them all and read them. But by 2007, there was a lot in the newspapers. But remember, the hedge funds at Bear Stearns didn't blow up until June 2007. I finished this in 2008, so the majority of the big books about it didn't come out then. I was finishing it when Lehman Brothers exploded.
The bond traders in your story are almost all men. Are there women in this field?
Yes, there are, but not many.
And they're all very young. So is India at 38 considered kind of over the hill?
She's considered an old lady, and I have fun with that in the book. But they tell her to play young, and she does. She tries.
Is this a field where people come right out of college, make fortunes, and then leave? And if they've made enough money, actually try their hand at writing?
I suppose. What I've noticed is that they come in young, impossibly young, right out of great places like MIT. This is a very different world than the one that Michael Lewis described so brilliantly in Liar's Poker. These are real kids, very well educated, really, really smart. And I think we don't know yet whether they'll retire at 50 and move on because they're still so impossibly young.
And they bet on everything. They have hamburger eating contests and water tasting contests.
That's right.
This is all based on real fact?
Things that I learned from talking to people, yes.
I know somebody who used to be a banker for these four brokers, and almost all of them had problems with their gambling debts.
Oh, I didn't notice that. I think
you wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know.
The bankers might know more because right. They sometimes had to cover expenses for right. People who they knew were going to get a lot of money in the next bonus. But still,
right.
It was kind of shocking, some of the things that she discovered.
Well, the bond traders that helped me are so busy. I just can't imagine that they would have a lot of time for betting.
So you were writing this book during this period of transition. Did you feel like all the stuff was dropping into your lap, or was it just making it more complicated?
It was making it more complicated. It was like trying to outrun an avalanche. I was very confused. I had to learn a lot. I had great people helping me. They read the book for me, they explained it. But it was absolutely exhilarating. It was fascinating.
Do you take a period to rest before you start working on the next?
Yes.
Are you doing that now?
Yes, very much so. This time I've taken quite a bit of time before starting a new novel because this one took a lot out of me to write, but it was a lot of fun to write.
Well, if somebody tries to tempt you to go into another field, stick to the writing.
I think
you're
I
doing
will.
Well.
Thank you.
Martha McPhee's latest novel is called Dear Money, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.